You're listening to The World Cafe. I'm Talia Schlanger. So you hear a lot of different types of music on this show, right? But today's guest, well, I am willing to bet you've never heard anything quite like her. Her name is Tanya Tagaq. She's collaborated with Bjork, and she's won Canada's prestigious merit-based award, the Polaris Music Prize. Here's a little taste of what Tanya Tagaq sounds like. That's a piece of Retribution, the title track off Tanya's latest album, and all the vocal sounds you hear there are made by Tanya. They're based on her interpretation of Inuit throat singing, an ancient tradition that was originally performed as a friendly competition between two women in the North. Tanya and I talk about how she brings that tradition to punk and electronica. Tanya herself is Inuk. She comes from Cambridge Bay, Nunavut, a remote community of about 1,500 people in northern Canada. She spent time in a residential school, and if you don't know what that means, well, it is a tremendously dark part of contemporary Canadian history. Tanya will explain what residential schools were and their devastating effects. She's a proud and passionate advocate for First Nations rights, which shows up in her music and in our chat. We're going to talk for a bit before she performs. Now listen to the way Tanya speaks in conversation, how calm, warm, and gentle her voice is. And then get ready to be totally startled when she performs about halfway through, how her voice becomes visceral and powerful. It is really something. Ready? Here we go. Tanya Tagaq, so happy to have you. Welcome to the World Cafe.
Thank you. It's so awesome to be here.
Yeah, we're really pleased to have you. So you hail from Canada, from Cambridge Bay, Nunavut originally. Mm-hmm. And for people who have never seen a picture or been there, can you paint me a picture of what the land looks like?
Nunavut's a huge expanse. It goes from one end of the continent to the other, above the Arctic Circle. So it's huge. So there's a very wide variance of topography and how the land looks like. There's mountain ranges in some area, but some areas where I'm from in Cambridge Bay, it's flat and there's no trees because it's above the Arctic Circle and the sea ice is thick, sometimes 10 feet thick, and 24-hour sun in the summer.
Wow.
24-hour darkness in the winter for 3 months at a time. So really the year is like a long day. So it's beautiful, and it's very harsh, and it's very pristine.
Yeah. And what's the community like up there? Are there a lot of people around you? Is it a very tight-knit sort of space?
Well, there's a series of communities spread across Nunavut, and there's small towns ranging from the largest one around 10,000 approximately, and the smallest one. You know, when I was growing up, Brown Sound, I think there was 30 people there.
Wow.
But the government really wanted us in community so that Canada could claim the Northwest Passage, right? So we were basically forced into communities. But they're small communities, and there's no roads, obviously, because it's across the Arctic Ocean. Like, you can't really drive from one to another.
Mm-hmm.
So it's super isolated. And it's the more the feeling like the land owns us than we own the land, because there's such a vast expanse surrounding us, and we have to fly by jet from community to community. So you learn a lot of really beautiful things, like how to accept each other properly and tolerate each other. And also there's a huge lack of pretense, because you can pretend to be something, but your actions are who you are. So everyone in the community knows who you are. You can't pretend to be a good person, or you can't hide your flaws. So people are a lot more open. And it was a huge culture shock when I first went south.
Mm-hmm.
I got in a lot of trouble. I got in trouble.
Okay, what kind of trouble did you get into?
Well, there was a few things that happened when I first went down to Halifax, where, yeah, number one, it was a social thing where I didn't understand if you're gonna be snaky, you have to be able to stand behind it. Like, if you're gonna lie or if you're gonna be in my face, you're typically And again, I don't want to speak for all Inuit, but typically you better be able to back that up, right? So, and that's a segment of society I never quite understood. And as I traveled, I got used to it. Like, you know, when I was living in Spain and I heard somebody like insult the other person, like, oh, I hope your mother dies of cancer or something. And it's like, you say that in Nunavut, you're getting your ass kicked, right? So here I was in, I was so angry. Here I was in Halifax, like kind of being faced for the first time with this idea where I had to let people mistreat me in a way I wasn't used to. And sometimes I would, you know, react in violence, basically.
Really?
I was kind of a kicker, yeah.
Like yeah, throwing fists?
Well, yeah. And it's like I've kind of learned the hard way not to do that anymore, but like it's sometimes difficult for me because it's a thing where people don't, it's a cultural thing, like socially, like, you know, if you're in a room with a bunch of people and you bring in your stressy pollution and being angry and upset about small things, that affects the psyche of everyone around you. So typically Inuit won't stir that pot unless it's something really, really important, because living harmoniously is a priority. So when somebody's purposely kind of agitating everyone, there would be a confrontation, and not necessarily a physical one, but there would be a confrontation. And also, like, I grew up, you know, more connected to nature. So I couldn't understand this mentality of, like, being ashamed of your body, like that your breasts or something wrong with your breasts, right? And, of course, there I was, like, 19 and so proud of mine. I was, like, letting the flag fly so hard. I got kicked out of my dorm. almost got kicked out of my dorm. And I just didn't understand why people had to have all these rules surrounding sex. Like, say, I remember being up at home, and it's a 24-hour darkness, and there's nothing to do for 3 months, and you're sitting there with your best friend, and you've watched 5 movies in a row, and it's minus 55 outside, and you're like, oh, I want to get it on? And it's like, okay. Like, it's there. Can And then because it's a small community, inevitably when two people break up, they're going to eventually start dating people you know. So you learn how to just kind of deal with each other socially in a different way. And there's just so many different rules, right? So I didn't understand why I was supposed to be ashamed of my body or ashamed of any sexual encounters I may have run into. So I think that in my dormitory, people just didn't know how to handle me. And I had a lot of energy back then. Like, I was kind of just getting in trouble. And I remember going to a park in Halifax and sitting on the park bench, and there were a bunch of ducks, like, around my feet. And, you know, you spend your whole life, you know, watching people hunt these things or hunting these things. And it's like just little things, like I'd want to snap one's neck and bring it home. You know, stuff like this that's like completely culturally associated. So those were some of the ways I got into trouble.
We're going to hear you perform for us. And it would be reductive to say that this is Inuit throat singing because it's many things. Mm-hmm. And the sound is so rich and the vocal range that you have is spectacular. But one of the roots, I guess, of the sound that we're going to hear is in the tradition of throat singing. Would you explain to me where that comes from and what it is?
Absolutely. And thank you for asking, because we've been grappling with this for a while, because who I am is so attached to my culture, being born and raised up there in Nunavut. And, you know, I'm Inuk, and my mom's Inuk, my father's English. And throat singing is a thousands of years old tradition that is a call and response, friendly competition between two women. Like, it's very, very endearing and technically super difficult. And this is part of the root of what I do, but it isn't traditional, not even close to being traditional. So sometimes I wonder if I should be called a throat singer. And technically I am throat singing, but I also am a vocalist.
Exactly.
I explore all the range of my voice, and I don't adhere to the rules surrounding traditional throat singing at all. Like, I sing alone, and it's improvised, and I don't harness any particular sound or pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes within my community, there's people that are saying, like, you shouldn't call yourself a throat singer. And I grapple with it because I am throat singing, and I'm not trying to represent an entire group of people, but I'm so Inuk. You know, like, how do I move back and forth with this? Because if I just said vocalist, people might not grasp the sounds that are coming, I think, from the land, you know, from my background.
How did you, coming from the isolated space that you mentioned and thinking about the tradition of two women playing this sort of loving challenge vocal game with each other, how did you take those bones, those basics, and turn them into what you do? Like, when did that idea come to you?
Well, this is another big topic that we... there's so many things we don't have time to talk about.
Yeah.
Where my family originates from is different from where I grew up. Where I grew up in Cambridge Base in the Central Arctic, and it was heavily affected by the residential school program.
And for Americans who are hearing this and don't know what that is, would you just give us the basics?
Yeah. It's important that if you're interested, just look it up. There isn't a lot of positivity that came out of Indigenous children being ripped from our homes and brought to places where sometimes the death rate was at 75%, and very harrowing experiences of our people where the government attempted to assimilate us. But through that process, it was extremely abusive and very dangerous, and there are mass graves, and children were abused and unable to speak their language, and sometimes not seeing their family for a decade, and it was forced. There was no choice. So, I mean, I don't have time to get into it too much. I went to residential school for high school, but it was voluntary. Like, I didn't have to go.
Mm-hmm.
So that was near the end. The last residential school closed down in 1996, and the government is admitting between 6,000 to 10,000 children died, but it was way more. Like, 150,000 children were ripped from their families, but I think the number is actually closer to 50,000 that died. And
like, what time period is this? Like, we don't think of Canada that way.
Well, the last one closed in 1996.
Yeah.
Anyway, in Cambridge Bay, it was heavily affected by the residential school program, and that includes the direct result of that is people coming back traumatized, you know, abused, and that carrying on, because when you break people, it's hard. It's like when people go to war, right? You break them and it's hard for them to move forward. That, in conjunction with our own judicial system being just dismantled and a foreign judicial system implemented, made a terrible equation. But not a lot of people were speaking any Inuknaqtun, and I didn't hear throat singing growing up. And that's particular to Cambridge Bay, Central Arctic. Like, I don't want to speak for the entirety of Nunavut, because I know in other places throat singing stayed alive. So I went to residential school, finished that, and went down to university in Halifax. And my mother was sending me, like, care packages, and I heard throat singing properly, like, you know, on a cassette tape. And I just started throat singing, and it felt like I could have a piece of home with me, because I was so lonely. You know, I was sick of the car exhaust. I was sick of people. I was sick of not being able to be myself properly. And it just, It's not something like where I was scratching my chin and went, oh, this would be a good idea. It's an actual amalgamation of the cultures that I've been subjected to.
Let's hear you do what you do. And just so people know listening, I mean, the melodic and gentle voice that they hear now coming out of you, Tanya Tagak, is about to transform. And all of the vocal sounds are made by you.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay. Yeah.
This is Tanya Tagak performing live at the World Cafe. This is Tanya Tagak performing live at the World Cafe. You summon so much when you're in performance like that, or it seems like you're summoning so much. I mean, we hear sounds coming out of you that is hard to attribute to just one singular being. So when you're performing like you do, what are you thinking of, or what are you accessing?
Well, if I'm going to be totally honest.
And please do, yeah.
I feel like I'm just finally in reality, and this is all fake. Because we set it up this way as humans. We set it up to put all these things on top of ourselves so we can feel terrible. It's just, it's the freedom of my flesh. It's freedom. It's just freedom.
Yeah.
And I don't like following rules. I don't like...
Really?
Yeah, I find it really boring. I find it boring to kind of hang on to too much...
There aren't a lot of words in what you do, and yet it's inherently political. So I suppose I want to know what you would like people to think about, or what you would like to incite people to do who are listening to your music.
Well, one thing people, a desperate message I'd like to get across, and these are really, like, all the things I'm saying are, like, baseline, basic topics that if we had any length of time, we could penetrate. But as it is right now, when speaking to mass groups of people, I try to keep things not as simple as possible, but as pure as possible to get the message out. And inevitably, a lot of people listening will already know all these things, right? But this continent, in order for it to have been taken with slavery and genocide, there had to be a prevailing attitude that people were godless or didn't have a spirit, or their cultures were inadequate, that we were heathen, we were savage, we were dirty, we were stupid, we didn't have technology, we didn't have science, all this stuff. And this wasn't long ago. This is just a couple generations, and a lot of people are walking through this time right now on this land thinking that that doesn't apply to them, but it's a subconscious social thing that we even carry ourselves as Indigenous people, that we carry, every single one of us are living in this society, and the dominance has infected all of our thinking. So we have to break free from that. And it's a deep thing that requires a lot of work. And I understand how hard that would be to be somebody that's not affected by that subconscious stream of thought, thinking it's not there. But that's everyone has work to do. Everyone has work to do, but there's certain demographics that are paying with our lives. So it's not, you do the work. You do the work. Because we're dying. Just do it. Just do the work. You know, we're doing the work too. It's just time to believe. It's time to, like, believe in equality.
Yeah.
And it's, especially, it's been, like, it's difficult coming down here to America and, like, seeing...
Why?
Because it's like immigrants complaining about other immigrants. You know, as an Indigenous person, it's like, what the hell are you doing? Like, you know, and I mean, you can start tabbing off the racist bingo card now, where people are like, well, everyone's immigrants. Well, it's not. When you have villages that are 150,000 years old being discovered in BC, it's like, no, you can't, like, start talking like that. It's there. It's and the saddest thing about this, I find, is that when we're being judged as Indigenous people, like people accusing me of not paying taxes, for example. And actually I'm paying the same taxes, but we don't get the good healthcare system. You know, like it's all these like myths that come across that are rooted in fear. And a lot of people not understanding how and why we're statistically in this spot. And I don't want to, definitely don't want to speak for all people of color. I don't want to speak for all Indigenous people. And I don't want to speak for all Inuit. I am an individual coming forth with these ideas or thoughts. And luckily enough, I have a platform. Thank you very much. But it's just a call to arms for everyone, you know, for everyone. And we're doing our end of the work as much as we can.
In 2016, towards the end of it, you released Retribution and found yourself written up about in Rolling Stone and in New York Magazine and in Pitchfork.
What does Retribution mean to you?
Retribution... Retribution, I named it Retribution because Canada keeps touting this idea of reconciliation and it's going way too slow. And it's just different. Like, you know, when you're somebody who is hearing every few weeks of a major tragedy and lives are being lost, it's not like a... It's all this stuff, like the stuff being written up and all of this idea of like fame or success, that's kind of second to the main thing. Like I feel like there's two things happening. One is I love making music, and it is protest music, but it's not a conscious thing, you know. But and so there's the joy, absolute joy of making music. And to be honest, I really think I wouldn't be here on the planet if I didn't have that outlet. You know, I'm observing something that is already laying right in front of me, and it's just coming out. It's strange. It's a really wonderful thing. And when I see people like making music because they want to get famous, I always find it really lame. Like, I mean, I don't know if you're allowed to say lame anymore. I think that's not a good word.
Oh, it might be loaded. Yeah. But you're not into it. Yeah.
I'm not into it.
Thank you so much for being here, Tanya.
You're welcome. Sorry I said lame.
Don't be sorry. Well, then we had a lovely learning moment and then corrected it. And that's all one can ask oneself to do, huh? Thank you so much. You're listening to The World Cafe.